welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are glad you are spending time with us today. Coming up in just a bit, we'll go back to The Tell, Fargo's live storytelling showcase. It returns Thursday, November 15th, upstairs at the 4 and 4 above Side Street Grill and Pub in Fargo, and the theme will be Frenemies. Plus, we'll note that one of Fargo's own storytellers, Stacy Nicholson of Moorhead, will be featured nationally on the Moth Radio Hour this Sunday at 2 o'clock, and you can hear that right here on Prairie Public. Dr. Tom Ezern stops by with another of his Plainsfolk essay about a 20th century Larimore veterinarian who is devoted to animals and his neighbors alike. And we begin Main Street today with a question. Did you know Fargo was the scene for one of the most beloved jazz albums of all time? Duke Ellington's show at the then Crystal Ballroom in 1940 would have been just another whistle stop on the Jazz Pioneers Fall Tour were it not for a couple of enterprising college students. 8 decades later, a group of college music professors and local jazz musicologists are getting ready to recreate that night, which eventually became immortalized on the vinyl and by the Recording Academy. Eric Dethridge has the story.
And not to quote Kiss or even Chuck Klosterman, but Fargo, Jazz City.
There's a lot of people that come out for jazz. We have the FM Kicks big band.
That is Matt Patnode. He's an NDSU music professor and member of Funky Fargo Collective Post-Traumatic Funk Syndrome. His fellow music professor across the river at Concordia, bandmate and jazz enthusiast, is Russ Peterson.
Every Monday night at Side Street, 7 o'clock p.m., free jazz, a different group every week. All ages, no cover charge, come on.
Aside from the no-brainer of great live jazz music, there's nothing quite like it really, Russ says there's an academic reason why musicologists flock to the FM area.
The 3 colleges in town all have 3 full music departments, all full-time music faculty from all over the country. And what do? You start groups.
And what started as kind of a wild hair by a couple of college students from a long time ago, Jack Towers from South Dakota State University and Richard Burris from NDSU, both were extension students, both jazz fans, both worked at their respective campus radio stations, became a document of a legendary evening on the snowy prairies that was waxed into music immortality. Here is the late Jack Towers from a 2011 NPR interview.
So we noticed that our idol, Duke Ellington, was going to appear in Fargo, North Dakota at the Crystal Ballroom. And so we sent off a note to the William Morris Agency in New York to get permission from Duke's people for recording. We figured it would be just about like one of the band pickups that we heard broadcast all the time, so why not us do it with our disc recording equipment?
And Jack and Richard recorded not to tape, but directly onto a 16-inch aluminum acetate-coated disc, basically using a phonograph. So the story is Duke and the band listened to the playback and were kind of impressed. There was a little trepidation about the trumpet player. It was the first show with new horn player Ray Nance, who replaced longtime trumpeter Cootie Williams. Jack and Dick agreed not to release it commercially, but eventually the discs got passed around among band members, friends, and eventually it became a bootleg collector's item. In 1974, when Sir Duke passed away, his family released the album officially, and in 1980, don't know why it took so long, Duke Ellington at Fargo 1940 Live picked up the Grammy for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album. So all Homer bias aside, how does this record, this album, this live album, stand the test of time?
Well, first thing I'm going to say is I'm going to repeat a phrase that Miles Davis used. He said, once a year, the entire planet should get on one knee and thank Duke Ellington. So his contribution to music, not just jazz, because you got to think of this time. I mean, he's inventing jazz. This wasn't happening before Duke was doing this. Other people picked up on it. But Duke started doing this, man. It's like he invented this art form. People kept taking it from the, 40s, 50s, and 60s to different places. But, man, Duke's kind of the father of it all.
So that's what he means, right? Duke. When we say Duke is such a great musician and just timeless musician, what is it elementally about his playing, about his, skills as a band leader that make him such an iconoclast of music, period?
Well, he was a great writer and arranger. And I think when you listen to his music, you hear it's classic American writing, just like we would look at Aaron Copland or Leonard Bernstein. It's just as unique there. It was just jazz and not classical. Many of his tunes, I think of Mood Indigo, how beautiful that close harmony was. And he also had players in the band for years playing over and over. He wrote special tunes with these guys in mind, soloists like Johnny Hodges. Russell will be playing Prelude to a Kiss when we do this. And also, he paid the band pretty well, so they stayed in that band if they could. A lot of big bands at the time featured different players on different recordings. You might find, for instance, Ben Webster's playing on this tour, but he also played with the Count Basie group. So a lot of players went from band to band with whoever was on tour, whoever had a gig for them. And Duke Ellington kind of brought it together with personalities and keeping an orchestra together. So it's really more of an orchestra. His writing, to me, he used soloists in certain ways. He also used, like, his saxophone writing as a saxophonist. I always hear this. He had a strong lead alto and also a strong baritone saxophone player, Harry Carney.
Now we present our feature baritone saxophonist, Harry Carney, in the solo role of a little song tune, Slap Happy.
And always some clarinet in some of the older recordings.
Mm-hmm. A story I heard was guys wanted to keep their job in this band, so they played so often, they memorized the book. And then they threw the book away. Well, you throw it away. Nobody else can take your gig now, man. It's just you.
Irreplaceable.
Irreplaceable.
Thank you. And now it's my pleasure to present that very dynamic personality, Ivy Anderson.
If you thought you had to be careful around the record player back in the day when you played back an album, imagine recording one live in a pretty tightly packed space with people not exactly sitting on their hands. But that's exactly what Jack Powers and Richard Burris had to contend with.
They couldn't be too close to the band because that would move the needle back then if the band got too loud.
They're tapping their feet too much, huh?
But this is a live recording. They did many live recordings then, and it was a dance. So a lot of the tunes are fairly short. They're under 5 minutes. People are dancing, and you can hear a lot of noise in the background. People, glasses clinking and feet stomping.
And to mark the 85th anniversary of the concert at the then Crystal Ballroom at Broadway and South First in downtown Fargo on a cold, snowy night, November 7th, 1940, some all-star Fargo-Moorhead jazz musicians are recreating that evening, minus hopefully the rough weather. Details, please.
Sure, we're going to be playing live at the Side Street downtown Fargo on November 10 at 7 p.m., and basically, it's a tribute to this record. We're going to play several of the tunes from the record, how they were originally. But then we're also going to play, and this is Matt's idea, we're going to play newer versions of these tunes.
Thank you. And now we bring you our bass player, Jimmy Blandon, in the solo role of our radio theme, Sepia Panorama.
One of my favorites is Sepia Panorama, which is a little slower swing kind of tune, but it's not as well known, but discovering this on that album is fantastic, and we're lucky enough to have many of these transcriptions in our library at NDSU.
The Crystal Ballroom,
which was on the second floor of an armory building, well, it was demolished in 1962. An apartment building facing Island Park sits there now, and on the west-facing wall in the alley behind Rumbus Guys, a mural of Duke Ellington playing a piano and bathed in a greenish-blue, maybe indigo, commemorates this incredible night of jazz music in Fargo, North Dakota, which is immortal now on wax and digital streams, though you'll have a hard time finding it on Spotify. YouTube is not a bad place, or your local public library. Now, some things to acknowledge. When Duke Ellington and his band arrived in Fargo, it was at the Great Northern train station. There's now a bike shop there. But apparently they had to lug all their equipment and walk several blocks in the cold and snow to the Crystal Ballroom. And if you're wondering where they stayed.
Fargo was segregated at that time, like most American cities, sadly. And the band actually stayed in special hotels for African Americans. And they were in boarding houses down off 2nd Avenue, which don't no longer exist.
The infamous Green Book, which helped African Americans find safe lodging, might have given them a tip on options at the time. There's also some photos of that night at the Crystal Ballroom on the wall at the Delta by Marriott across from West Acres Mall. It hangs on the outside of their, yep, Crystal Ballroom. Oh, what a night it was, and what a night it will be at the 4&4 above Side Street on Monday, November the 10th, starting at 7 p.m. And if you missed that show, the FM Ellington Tribute Band will recreate the experience too in Detroit Lakes at the Historic Holmes Theater on November the 14th at 7:30.
What's special is how Duke Ellington orchestrated, what the four trumpets did, what the five saxophones did, and that's what we're excited to recreate, the exact stuff that Duke wrote.
Now, if you think you have to venture to the Twin Cities for an excellent live jazz music experience, I mean, the Dakota's a pretty nice club, but hey, don't sleep on Fargo. This city is steeped in legendary jazz music history. You think about Duke Ellington at Fargo 1940 Live, but presently too, just a lot of great bands like Post Traumatic Funk Syndrome and talented musicians plucked from local universities. Fargo is Jazz City.
That was Eric Dethridge, along with Concordia Associate Music Professor Russ Peterson and NDSU Music Professor Matt Patinode, two of the organizers and among many of the Fargo-Moorhead jazz musicians known as the FM Ellington Tribute Band, getting ready to recreate Duke Ellington at Fargo 1940 Live at the 4&4 in Fargo Monday, November 10th, and in Detroit Lakes at the Historic Holmes Theater.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Tell, Fargo's live storytelling event, is back on Thursday, November 15th at the 4&4 above Side Street Grill and Pub with a pretty juicy theme, Frenemies. Wild Things was the loose topic at last month's event, and Denise Johnson clearly got the memo. Here's her tale titled Wild and Green.
So, this all begins with a mother's love, my mother. My mother would do anything for her children, and in fact has. When I was a little girl, my aunt, my crazy beloved aunt, brought home this teeny tiny little kitten that fit in the palms of her hand. And we all loved to see my Aunt Dorothy coming into the yard as a crazy bat out of hell driver. She'd race into the yard and we'd all, my grandmother would, my mom would hold us back and say, "Don't go until the car stopped, you'll get run over." And we ran out to the car and my aunt handed me this kitten and says, "Go ask your mom if you can keep it." I was three. Who tells a little three-year-old girl that they can't have this teeny tiny little black kitten? Certainly not my mother. So Years later, I have two younger brothers. Now the youngest brother really, really wants a puppy. And they go and look at some little dachshunds at Adopt-A-Pet here in Fargo. And the lady was very smart. She handed the dachshund, two dachshunds, one to each boy, and says, "Oh, hold the little dachshunds while we do the paperwork." You know, my parents went home with two dachshunds that day instead of one. So my mother will do anything for her children. And even if that involves something wild and green that later becomes a pet. The boys were young. I was in high school and didn't go on the trip. I might have even been in college, I'm not sure, but my brothers were little. And they go to Florida. And they go and they're gonna do the whole Disney thing, and they're gonna see my mom's sister who lives in Florida, and they're gonna do this whole big Disney trip, and it's gonna be the best trip ever. It was 50 degrees in Florida that week. Disney was miserable. It was cold and wet and rainy and lots of long lines. It was February. It was Valentine's Day. It was my brother's birthday on the 15th of February. And that child wanted nothing more for his fifth birthday than an iguana. And my aunt says, "Well, we'll get you an iguana here. We'll get a baby iguana, and you can take the baby iguana home to Fargo, and that iguana will be your best friend, and he will love you for a long time." And my parents said, "Sure, let him have the iguana. It's fine. They eat vegetables, not bugs. It's great." So my mom calls the airline, and she says, "Can we bring a pet on the plane?" And they say, "Well, of course you can bring a pet on the plane." When she showed up at the desk and the pet was an iguana in a shoebox, needless to say, the airline did not think that was a pet. And they said, "You can't take an iguana on the plane. Are you crazy? That is not a pet. A pet is a dog or a cat. You're not bringing that wild green thing on the plane." Hence starts the five-year-old sobbing, ugly crying at the airport. "But it's my pet, and it's my birthday. What am I going to say?" So like any good mother, my mom said, turns around to her sister and says, "Gee, Susan, I'm really sorry. You're going to have to keep the iguana until you come home in a couple of months to Minnesota and bring the iguana with you then." And my aunt says, "Well, yes, of course, we can keep the iguana. It's not a problem. You know, we'll just bring it home when we drive home in the summer." In the meantime, my mother has slipped her hand into the shoebox, picked up the tiny baby green iguana, and put it in her pocket. Now, this was a while ago, so it's before all the body scanners and such. Otherwise, she probably would not have been on the plane and might be on the do not fly list currently. However, she is not on the do not fly list anyway. She might be crazy, but those are two different stories. So she gets on the plane with an iguana in her pocket. So they get all the way from Tampa to Chicago. What happens in Chicago in February? Blizzards. They are stranded in the Chicago airport for 12 hours with an iguana in my mother's pocket. Needless to say, they have to figure out how to feed the iguana. So they feed the iguana some lettuce out of a sandwich, and they're trying to keep the iguana warm. So rather than keep the wild green iguana in her pocket, my mother shoves it down the front of her shirt and ended up flying home to Fargo with an iguana in between her cleavage. And the iguana lived many years, and his name was Pocket.
That was Denise Johnson's story about a pocket iguana from last month's version of The Tell, the live monthly storytelling event at the 4 and 4 in downtown Fargo. Their next show is Thursday, November 15th. Details on The Tell's Facebook page and Instagram. The Tell, as you probably have guessed, is inspired by the long-running live storytelling radio show and roving live shows, The Moth. You might remember The Moth put on two shows in North Dakota last November. Well, we're excited to tell you that one of the local storytellers, Stacy Nicholson, of Moorhead's story, The Cool Table, will air on this Sunday's Moth Radio Hour at 2 p.m. Central, 1 Mountain. You'll hear the Fargo Theater well represented. Make sure you listen into The Moth again Sunday at 2 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, a provider of live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and streaming services for events, conferences, and meetings across the Prairie region and around the country. More information at livewirenow.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For decades, detasseling corn was a summer tradition for thousands of Nebraska teenagers. A first job that built character and paid for school clothes and maybe a first car. But those jobs are becoming harder to find. Some contractors say big seed companies are replacing local teens with temporary foreign workers under the H-2A visa program. Harvest Public Media's Molly Ashford and the Midwest Newsroom's Nick Loomis look at how a new Nebraska law meant to shed light on who's doing the work may be falling short.
For 9 years, Scott Wilcox hired detasseling crews in Nebraska. He says young Nebraskans can do 100% of the summer job, often seen as a rite of passage. When biotech giant Bayer discontinued his contract in 2020, Wilcox suspected migrant workers with H-2A visas were hired instead.
I mean, you know, they don't have to take care of them like they are required to take care of us, the kids from Nebraska. So it was just a way cheaper way for them to go.
Employers must prove that no domestic labor is available to hire H-2A workers. Bayer said in a statement that it employs more local youth in Nebraska than any of its other U.S. production sites. Legislative aide Joel Hunt authored a bill that aimed to identify who performs the labor in seed corn fields and ensure local workers are prioritized. Hunt says it got watered down with amendments before it became state law in 2024. One of the changes shielded many hiring specifics from the public record.
So the Department of Agriculture has all of the numbers. What they're posting on the website is just what's required in statute.
He added that penalties for non-reporting were also removed.
There's almost no way to actually enforce this bill.
The Nebraska Department of Agriculture published the first annual report on September 30th.
What do we got? Four columns and two rows.
Brent Ailes is the co-owner of Ailes Detasseling in Lincoln, Nebraska.
And it's a very, very, what I might call a 30,000-foot view of not much detail.
The report shows that in 2025, mostly teenage crews performed 60% of detasseling. It's unclear what part of the remaining 40% was performed by H-2A crews because there are no details about the number of workers hired, who hired them, or where they came from. That missing information was the original intention of the law. Nebraska Department of Labor Commissioner Katie Thurber confirms that seed companies have gravitated toward H-2A labor in the past decade.
I think it's broadly popular because it's a known commodity as to what you're going to get. And I think it's really marketed to the agricultural industry so they know about its availability.
But local contractors say that young Nebraskans are available and point to wait lists as proof that they're being ignored.
I think it means there's probably a disconnect, not necessarily that the law isn't being followed.
Iowa farmer Mark Aaron says he always found plenty of teenagers from Cedar Falls to detassel. His contract was discontinued by corn behemoth Corteva Agriscience last year. With grain prices currently down, he wishes he still had that contract.
But probably the only money I would have made this year.
Aaron's estimates that 20% of detasseling is done by teenagers in Iowa, where there is no law to track the labor. Across the border, Brent Ailes says he's happy Nebraska lawmakers want to keep the job in local hands, even though the recent report hasn't been illuminating.
So I'm thankful that there is still a strong opportunity across the state for many, many kids to participate in detasseling if they choose to.
Ailes says some teenagers may prefer a service industry job to working in a cornfield in late July, but he says he still had a wait list. He hopes he'll have more acres so they can continue the tradition next year. With Harvest Public Media's Molly Ashford, I'm Nick Loomis with the Midwest Newsroom.
That story comes to us from Harvest Public Media and the Midwest Newsroom, a collaboration of public radio stations in the region. You can find more reporting on food, farming and rural life at harvestpublicmedia.org. Still to come on Main Street, a story about a 20th century Larimer veterinarian who was known for his devotion to animals and his neighbors alike. That and more ahead on Main Street, right after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Finnish comedian Ismo to the Fargo Theater Sunday, November 16th. Named the quote-unquote funniest person in the world in a 2014 contest by The Laugh Factory, Ismo collaborated with Merriam-Webster on an English-language comedy series. Details at jadepresents.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A black derby hat and a heart for animals. That's how folks in Larimore remember Dr. Herman Eisenlohr, a community vet who wore many hats, literally and figuratively. Here's Dr. Tom Ezern with this week's Plainsfolk.
People in Larimer, a century ago, recognized their veterinarian, Dr. Herman M. Eisenlohr, by his black derby hat as he came up the street. Figuratively, too, he wore many hats and was a truly colorful local character. I can tell you about Dr. Eisenlohr and his place in the community of Larimer only because of, and here I'm climbing onto one of my favorite soapboxes, only because of archives. Let me declare and illustrate, once again, the value of manuscript collections such as those gathered by the Institute for Regional Studies and housed at NDSU Archives. I'm writing today from Manuscript Collection 23, one of the early ones acquired by the Institute in the 1950s. Eisenlohr was the son, born in 1879, of German immigrants in Iowa, who raised him on a farm there until they relocated to a farm in South Dakota. Herman grew up and traveled back to Iowa to marry his sweetheart, Anna Olson, and then took her to a farm near Havana, North Dakota. Upon Anna's early death, Herman went off to vet school in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Upon achieving his degree, he was looking for a place to practice back in North Dakota and heard the vet in Larimer had died. So there he settled and practiced. He also farmed, kept a livery, and lived in it until his death in 1954. He was active in the associations of his profession and of his community, lodges, church, business, and so on. And now we come to the colorful part of Dr. Eisenlohr's profile. According to local historians, he was remarkably dedicated to animals. He continued with his humanitarian work treating animals day or night, whenever the call came, one of them writes. Sometimes this called for much cooperation on the part of the neighbors and friends when he would go into the ditch. So he commonly hired young men to drive him to calls in the country, first by horse-drawn rig, later by automobile. Eisenlohr was an avid gardener of flowers and vegetables and loved sharing the bounty with his neighbors. He spent untold hours helping to build the Methodist Church in 1913. In addition to the horses in his livery, he kept a regular menagerie of fowl, goats, dogs, and ponies on which he gave the town kids rides. He kept a taxidermic collection of freak animals he loved to show off. A great believer in education, he let country kids coming to town board horses at his livery for free. Now, back to the boxes in the archive. They contain two bound volumes bearing the legends Livery Record, 1912-1915, and Livery Record, 1915-1919. I am immediately struck that in early 20th century, the livery business was substantial enough that commercial publishers printed purpose-made ledgers in which to record their transactions. A few things of note in the livery records. Most of the customers renting rigs and horses were local. This included townsmen renting rigs and listing their destination simply as hunting. Many other times, the destination listed was just county, meaning someone in town had business or perhaps personal affairs to attend to on a farm somewhere. Sometimes a neighboring community is the destination, R. Vista, Northwood, East Gate, or a school, or a particular farm. Country doctors commonly rented rigs for rural house calls. The horses, they all had names. Blackie, Polly, Slim Dick, Jenny, Bailey, Gypsy, Topsy, Clyde, Baldy. Dr. Eisenlohr knew his horses and his people. And now we know him, too, through the archives.
That was historian and NDSU Distinguished Professor of History, Dr. Tom Ezern, with Plains Folk. You can find more stories from the prairie, past and present, at prairiepublic.org. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. From self-driving tractors to smart sensors, technology is transforming agriculture, but it also brings new risks. Prairie Public's Todd McDonald reports on how cyber threats are finding their way into the farm field.
You know, there absolutely is cybersecurity when it comes to ag.
Nick Dushek is an assistant director with NDSU's High Performance Computing Division. He says all those items are connected to the internet in some fashion, and as a result, are potential targets for attack.
The emerging area of cybersecurity concern is the Internet of Things, or IoT. So these wireless devices that are being deployed at the edge, meaning into fields. And these could be, you know, weather sensors, like temperature, pressure, humidity. They could be soil sensors. Or, you know, another thing that's gotten a lot of attention are drones.
Dr. Greg Wettstein is principal engineer for the Division of Internet Technology at NDSU. He says we've entered a point in time where agriculture is almost completely dependent on embedded systems and implements.
Great friend of mine from up in Minot just purchased a new sprayer. Spraying is the most critical thing that they do, given the cost of the chemicals and potential impact on yields. They make extensive use of GPS for positioning to determine where they're spraying. And in fact, he will tell you stories about that. They'll be sitting there at 7 o'clock in the morning, unable to take advantage of calm winds and cool temperatures because the electronics, for whatever reason, in the sprayer don't work. And therefore, the sprayer doesn't move, let alone emit the chemicals in the proper ratios and orders.
Wettstein says the days of hacking into a system to do damage are dwindling. Instead, he says the focus of today's intrusions is more data-based and part of what he calls the long game.
Infiltrating combines to gain yield information. And obviously yield information is important because if you know potential yields, it puts you in a position to either play or manipulate commodity markets.
Wettstein says while a farm field in rural Burke County may seem benign, the data produced by that field is very valuable.
In the 70s and 80s, there was always the term GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. And that's exactly the case it is with artificial intelligence models. The models are only as good as the data that is used to either A, train the model, or B, for the model to react on after it's been trained. So if you poison the data sources, you can potentially manipulate the intelligence models.
The Federal Department of Homeland Security works with the Department of Agriculture through the Information Sharing and Analysis Center. Agriculture cyber attacks are one area they closely monitor. And recent numbers show the number of reports in 2025 has nearly doubled for every month this year when compared to 2024. Again, Nick Dushek.
Nobody is immune to cyber attacks, but certainly if you're choosing equipment from reputable vendors that you have an established relationship with and you have recourse to them if something goes wrong, then you're going to be in a better position than if you were just kind of buying whatever you can find online and putting it in your field.
Dushek and Wettstein say there are efforts underway at NDSU and elsewhere to create new methods of detecting and preventing cyber attacks, as well as bolstering cybersecurity. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
That was Prairie Public's news reporter, Todd McDonald, exploring cybersecurity in modern agriculture. You can hear more stories like this at prairiepublic.org. Thank you. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Ira Flatow. If you love learning things, you're going to feel a sense of awe and wonder when you listen to Science Friday every, you guessed it, Friday evening at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public. Tap into your curiosity and learn something new every week. I can't wait for you to join us.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and whether you are 5 or 55 or maybe even older than that like me, the North Dakota Gateway to Science has a way to make you wonder. And this month, the Science Center based in Bismarck is hosting a new lineup of events designed to bring families together through hands-on exploration. And with us is Education Director Alicia Kellum. She's going to let us know what's coming up and why there's always something exciting happening at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Alicia, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Hi, Craig.
All right. I've said it before. Your staff has said it before. There is something for everyone. What are the new highlights coming up for the rest of this calendar year?
We have so much going on. That's one of my favorite parts of the job. We do have one of our mini camps in November, on November 11th, coming up really quickly, and that is for the entire school day. We usually go with a BPS school calendar, and so they can have hands-on STEM activities all day long. They can sign up on our website. We are having our preschool discovery hours, which are becoming such a wonderful and fun thing. That will be November 12th and November 15th. It's always the second full Wednesday and Saturday of each month from 9 to 9:45. And in November, it's fall feelings. So we're partnering with Kids in Motion, which provide pediatric therapy and wellness, so they can explore emotions through their hands-on play for our youngest learners. The biggest thing coming up is Einstein Online. It's our signature fundraiser. It's the one fundraiser that we do all year long. It's a really big deal. The fun kicks off at 5:30 with lively cocktail hours and games and drinks and apps, lots of fun, and followed by dinner and a challenge. And it includes a silent auction as well as our live energy live auction.
What day is that, Alicia?
That is on November 21st. And it helps us fund our mission and brings hands-on science to communities around the state. And then also in November, we have, it's coming into December, we have our next Gateway After Dark adult event. It's an 18 plus stargazing event on December 6th from 6:30 to 9. So that includes gallery exploration. Damon Williams will present information relating to the stars and the moon and the sun. And we'll have some telescopes out for optimal star viewing outside.
Certainly learning is hands-on, but you also talk about, and I think you do this with purpose, joyful learning. What do you mean when you talk about joyful learning?
Well, joy is one of our keystones here at Gateway to Science. If you're not joyful in learning, the learning doesn't stick. And we should make everything in our life joyful. So when you come to any of our events, or you come to our gallery space, or if we come to you, joy is at the cornerstone. We love to laugh. We love to explore. That's why everything that we do is hands-on, because that's really where the joy in learning comes.
For first-time visitors, and when families walk through the doors of the North Dakota Gateway to Science in Bismarck, what should they expect?
Well, that joy is definitely there. There is lots of giggling, lots of fun. I think there is a misconception. Sometimes people bring their kids and think, well, this really isn't for me. And one of my favorite parts is to watch some adults come in, and at first they sort of stand around. Within 10 to 20 minutes, they are hands-on, fully in, playing through all of the pieces of science. So that to me is one of my favorite parts to watch.
So where can people find more about events and details, and whether there's signups required, maybe an extra fee here or there? How can they understand what's coming up?
Absolutely. If you go to our website at gatewaytoscience.org and click on visit, There is a full calendar of events, and it goes through everything that's coming up well into the new year. There you can also find some more information about planning your visit. We are focusing a lot on accessibility and making sure that we have accommodations for everyone, so you can plan your visit even before you come.
And you're open your normal schedule through the rest of the year. You're going to be closed on Thanksgiving Day, though, correct?
Yes, but we will be open on Black Friday.
Sounds to me a lot funner to go to the North Dakota Gateway to Science than it does to rub elbow to elbow with everyone at the mall. So I think I might put that on my list.
Definitely. We'd love to have you.
That's Alicia Kellum. She's from the Gateway to Science. She's sharing what's ahead for this season. You can explore upcoming events and programs at gatewaytoscience.org and experience the joy of discovery for yourself and your family. Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and as November settles in across the northern plains, the landscape is in transition. The birds are flying south, animals are seeking shelter, and the plants are preparing for a long, cold rest. Naturalist Chuck Lura reflects on how wildlife and even trees adapt as Old Man Winter prepares his return.
November's upon us. We generally think that September, October, November as fall. And with winter waiting in the wings, the animals have basically three options: migrate, hibernate, or stay and endure it. The plants, however, have to be able to stay and endure it. By the end of the month, most migratory birds will have left. They've been getting ready for the trip. Migration might sound like a good and easy way out, but it has its risks and is energetically expensive. Some birds have to store up large amounts of fat before they start their migration, while others must stop periodically to stoke their biological furnaces. And even if they reach their destination, the habitat may be denigrated or destroyed. Hibernation enables animals to stay and avoid the cold and food scarcity. And similar to some migrating birds, the mammals that hibernate have to store up large amounts of energy reserves to get through the winter months. Then, of course, they must find a relatively safe and warm place to hibernate. It might come as a surprise, but hibernation is not all that common for mammals in the region. Many mammals will remain active over much of the winter, but find a warm place to hunker down during the cold spells. For those that do stay and tough it out, it's usually the cold, not snow, that is often the most serious factor. The mammals have put on their winter coats, and many animals will make behavioral and physiological changes that adjust to the winter cold. Mice and some other small mammals may be quite active under the big white insulating blanket of snow in what is called the subnivian, or undersnow world. With the exceptions, for example conifers, the plants in the region will go dormant. Many, such as the trees and shrubs, have already dropped their leaves. But plant tissues certainly can freeze, with ice crystals fatally ripping and tearing cells apart. However, they have anatomical and physiological adaptations to help them through the winter. A process called acclimation likely started in late summer with the shortening of days and cessation of growth. It involves the movement of some organic compounds, for example sugars and hormones, which makes the plants more hardy or resistant to below freezing temperatures. Think antifreeze-like substances. November can be unpredictable, but the animals and plants have been preparing for coming winter. With the exception of the migrants, by around the end of the month, they should be well prepared for the return of Old Man Winter. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. The tropical forests of southern Mexico are filled with songbirds, and this wren is one of the rarest. The sumacrest wren is a sooty brown bird about the size of a sparrow. They have long, straight bills and short, round wings that give their bodies a plump appearance. And though they mostly skulk out of sight, that haunting voice is crystal clear. Sumacrest's wrens are found in only a dozen or so locations in the tropical forests around Oaxaca and Veracruz. Their preferred habitat is often on steep hills and always includes limestone outcrops that provide the perfect crevices to build their nests and a natural amphitheater to show off their vocal feats. Another little brown bird in this region, called the Nava's wren, lives in the same type of habitat, but their ranges don't overlap. Until the 1990s, scientists thought that Nava's wren and Sumacrest's wren were separate populations of the same species. But listen to the Nava's wren sing. Now, here again is the Sumacrest's wren. Genetic studies eventually proved that these birds are distinct species, each with their own way to serenade their forest homes. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 6 is about Native contributions. It states, Native people continue to contribute to all levels of society, from local to global, in diverse fields, including medicine, science, government, education, economics, art, music, and many more.
In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Mark Bluestone, enrolled member of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation, talking about recognizing our veterans.
How important it is that we believe in recognizing our own local veterans. We have a veteran wall. We have two of them. We have the actual wall right outside our high school gymnasium, but we also have a secondary one that's right next to the cafeteria. So anyone who graduates from the Newtown School and wherever branch of service they went to, they get put on there. And so anyone who's on there, like Mr. Hunter, he's on there under the Marines. So we have all the Marines that graduated what year, all the Army, National Guard, all of those people. And we have them color-coded, too. So by decades, because sometimes when we first started this project, Mr. Moran and I and several others, Mrs. Reimer, we kind of laid it out and we said, we kind of sent out the responsibility of people to tell us, you know, who joined the service. And, you know, we have seen the 60s, you know, because of the Vietnam War, the pride that goes there when the people come in and they see their name in a certain color, and that's a decade, that's by decade. And so they come in, but, you know, you see the different people now, they're sometimes not very happy because if they didn't finish school, but they're still in our community or should have finished school, they're not on the wall. It's for graduates of the Newtown School District for that. And so sometimes there is some thought, well, I'm from here, I should be on there. Well, but did you graduate from Newtown High School? Like myself, I'm not on there, you know, but I didn't graduate from Newtown. But my three sons are up there because they graduated from Newtown. And I think that's also one of those things where that's recognition of all of that is important, that being veteran status, serving your country, that community service, our tribal service that we do, that they do, you know, should be recognized and it should be honored for that commitment anyway. So that's a really cool thing. And
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
That wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. You can listen to that live tonight at 7 p.m. or listen to the replay. Jeremy's topic this week, are you worried that AI will take your job? And Friday at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you next week right here on Main Street.